Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, America's caste system. It's a term generally associated with India, with its ancient and multi-layered class categories. Here in the U.S., the history is very different. But author Isabel Wilkerson says when it comes to understanding the oppression of Black people in this country, caste, not racism, is the better word. Caste, says Wilkerson, is a hierarchy that dictates where people stand in society, who gets access to resources, or even the benefit of the doubt. Isabel Wilkerson's new book is titled Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. Isabel, you say, first of all, that this was a book you did not want to write, but had to write in the era we find ourselves. Tell me about why.
Well, one of the reasons why is because I had spent so much time on the first book, The Warmth of Other Suns, and you know, I was telling the story of 6 million people who migrated out of the Jim Crow South. And in doing that, I didn't use the word racism to describe what they had endured. And I came to see the world differently. And so many things seem to come into place once you look at the world from the perspective of hierarchy that we've inherited. It's not anyone's fault. We've inherited it. It's here. It's the infrastructure of our divisions. And yet no one was looking at the world this way, the way that I had come to see it as these things were unfolding in recent years. And so because so much was happening, because the lens of caste shed so much light on divisions, on things that we otherwise would not see, I felt that I needed to write this because no one else was saying this. No one else was looking at the world this way. And it goes to explaining so much about our current situation.
Most of us look at the word caste and we think of that caste system as applying to India. But you're writing about racism in this country going back to 1619. So are you substituting the word caste for racism?
No, they are two separate things. The first has to do with what is race and what is caste. And race is the arbitrary assumptions about based upon what one looks like, meaning race is the skin. It's the visible manifestation that signals to each of us where an individual fits in the hierarchy that predates race as a concept. Caste is many thousands of years old. It predates the concept of what we now consider to be race. And so caste is the arbitrary, artificial hierarchy, the graded ranking of human value in a society that undergirds many other kinds of inequalities and injustices. It's all encompassing in such a way that any metric, any kinds of metrics could be used to delineate who fits where in a hierarchy and who has value. Such things as gender and national origin, immigrant status, religion, all of these things have been used to grade and create hierarchy. In the American context, the concept of race, meaning what people look like, has been the determining factor of historically of where a person would be placed in the infrastructure that was created when the country was founded, meaning actually before it was founded, when it was just a colony. And so when you think about the other caste systems, you know, it could be religion, as I said, you know, as we know of India, ethnicity as occurred in others. So in this country, race becomes what we call race, becomes the metric, the signal, the cue, the tool of delineating and thus enforcing difference. And also, I would say, differences in the way someone is perceived, one's standing, respect, benefit of the doubt that's accorded to them, access to resources or deprivation of resources. Race merely is the signifier of where a person fits in the hierarchy. And of course, this goes way back for many, many, many centuries.
So you say our country right now is a lot like an old house with a leaky basement. Explain that for us.
Well, I was trying to come up with many different ways of positioning it so that we could see what would otherwise be almost invisible to us. And so I came up with this this metaphor of the old house. You know, an old house, if you live in an old house, you know that the work is never done. There's always something that has to be attended to. As soon as you fix one thing, there's something else that has gone wrong. The work is never over. And anyone who has an old house knows that. And when there's the rains come and you don't want to go into the basement, if you don't go into the basement, it's at your own peril. And whatever's in the basement is lurking there, whether you choose to look at it or not. There's no escaping what is going on in an old house. You can choose to wish it away, but it is not going away, and it will be there to haunt you, and that there are consequences that you will have to face whether you choose to or not. So ignoring these things are not the way to deal with an old house, as we all know. And the old house that we live in, which is our country, has the same imperatives as well.
And you're saying that America has an unseen skeleton because a caste system, you say, is essential to its operation, as are the studs and joists of our homes. So how are we not seeing what's happening to this old house?
We are not seeing it because, as in an old house, the studs and the joists are not visible, and what you can see is what's visible. What we can see is race. What we cannot see is what race has been accorded to meaning and how we are responding to signals that we don't even realize. I mean, I describe that the caste is the bones, race is the skin, and then there's a third factor that gets mentioned quite a bit, which is class. And class would be the clothes, the diction, the accents, the ways of dressing, how we present ourselves to the world as a way of positioning ourselves, a way of, in some ways, compensating for what these other things don't permit us to do. And so with all of these things going on, we are most likely to see that's what is visible. We do not see the underlying infrastructure, the underlying architecture. And you're not meant to see the architecture of the building. You're supposed to go in and things move smoothly and you don't realize why. That's why it's actually so insidious, because it can be affecting us without realizing it. One way that I think that social scientists have come to sort of capture what caste does is with this concept of unconscious bias, meaning that we all have absorbed the messaging of this hierarchy. We've absorbed the messaging of, we recognize who is likely to be in the corner suite or the CEO of a company. We recognize who is more likely to perhaps maybe be homeless. We recognize who is more likely to be working on the front lines in the middle of COVID-19, for example. So that these are, in some ways, assignments of roles to people that have nothing to do with necessarily their own innate talents. I mean, there are many people who get law degrees and then decide, you know, I really, really am an artist, and this is really what I want to be. There are all these assumptions about what a person should be, and it all really restricts all of us in ways that we might not otherwise see. So the idea of the infrastructure that is there that we are not able to see is easiest to think about in terms of unconscious bias, one way that it operates within without our realizing it.
And why do you believe that it would be helpful to our country to understand our society's racial hierarchy as a caste system?
To me, the importance of looking at it as caste is that it takes the emotion out of the freighted language that we are accustomed to using. I think we need new language to accurately convey the phenomena that we live with today, the origins of the divisions that we now live with. We don't live with the same kinds of overt, naked, readily admitted even racism of our forefathers. You know, we don't live in a world in which there are cross burnings and Klan parades down major streets with thousands of people coming to cheer them on. We live in a different era in which the current day interactions may be below the surface, you know, not spoken of. People will not acknowledge or to being racist even if they were. And that's a word I actually don't use. You know, that's a word I simply don't use. So I think that our era calls for new language. Our era calls for a new way of looking at ourselves, a new lens with which to see what is actually underneath what we've inherited.
And explain what a caste system actually does. You start by saying it sets a presumed level of supremacy of one group over another.
In the, you know, the original ancient caste system of India, there are four main varnas and then many, many thousands of subcastes beneath those four that are often tied to, of course, lineage, but also occupation. It's very, very complicated, multi-layered fretwork of a system that is very, very different from the United States, but gives us an insight into how it operates here. Here, we have inherited essentially a bipolar caste system in which the founders of the country, I should say the colonists, the British colonists, position themselves, and actually they were the colonists, they positioned themselves as at the top. And then at the bottom were the people that they brought in to build the country as enslaved people. And that created a bipolar system with a fixed dominant group at the top of primarily starting with the British, and then a fixed bottom of enslaved people and now the descendants of enslaved people. That was the essential framework for building of the country, for the economics, for the social and political infrastructure of the country. That is what we have inherited from long ago. We now live with the shadow of that infrastructure. That's not the same as was before, but still has consequences for us today. We still live with the vestiges of that. And then what made it even further complicated is that and I should also say that this was something that was not an overnight creation. This is something that was built over the decades, the early decades of colonial Virginia and of basically the Chesapeake, and was refined, one might say, with the laws as they were viewed as being needed with other changes. They were sculpting a hierarchy that did not exist here before, did not exist in the same way anywhere else in the world, only because there had not been a place such as the New World where people were coming in from all over the world, existing in the same space and having to figure out how this was going to work. And so they created a bipolar infrastructure, in a hierarchy, and then it got complicated when new people would enter the hierarchy. Would enter the system. People coming in from Hungary or Poland or Ireland or wherever they might have been coming in from Europe did not conceive of themselves with the term white. White is not a way that the Europeans thought of themselves per se as a category. They might have described their skin being a particular color. They obviously could see when they ventured out to other parts of the world that people looked differently from them, but they didn't have the need to identify themselves solely on the basis of what they look like. That became more seductive once the hierarchy emerged here in the United States on this soil as the United States was being built. And so when anyone would come from these other places, they then had to navigate, coming in from Poland, coming in from Ireland, coming in from Hungary, had to navigate and discover that they were then being assigned to a category known as white. They were previously Irish, they were previously Polish, they were previously Hungarian. Arriving here, they were now a new designation, white. And that was in some ways the beginning of the codification and calcification of terms that we now take to be the natural order of the world.
But even though they were white, the Irish, the Italians, the Hungarians, they suffered as well. Certainly economically, certainly in terms of the kinds of jobs that they did. But you're saying that skin color defined them as being separate from those who were black.
Yes, that was the designation that was assigned them in the creation of this artificial hierarchy of graded ranking, that you couldn't just come into the system and just be who you might have wanted to be. You had to fit into whatever category had been created. And if you were coming from the category, of course, all these things seem perfectly normal to us now because we've accepted this has been in place for many centuries. But this book is calling upon us to think about the origins of this. How did we get to this point? If you think about, you know, about the current designation that distinguishes the categories that we now live with, it could just have easily have been height. That's a reference that I make in the book, that it could have easily have been height, which is also about 70 or 80% dependent upon lineage. It's something that you inherit. It's something that distinguishes people. I mean, the extremes of adults could range from below 5 feet to, 7 feet. So there's a huge difference in how people might look. And if they had chosen that as a distinction, it might be a different world. And we would be saying, obviously, height is the reason why that you can see that these people are smarter and these people are lazier. Obviously, that is the way that the world is. We accept that. And this is asking us to think differently and to recognize how arbitrary and artificial many of these designations are and were from the beginning. It was just it was to the convenience of the people who were forming this new society to divide people on the basis of that because they needed to get the work done.
What about the church as a hierarchy? What role did the church play?
In the forming of a hierarchy or a caste system, there is frequently the sense that there needs to be a justification for the hierarchy, some rationalization that speaks to natural law or higher power that has designated certain people as superior and other people as inferior. And each of the hierarchies might have something that justifies it. For the Western world, turned to Genesis and to the story of Noah and his son, Ham, who happened to have seen his father unclothed and therefore was cursed. And so Western philosophy, Western religion deemed or designated the children of Ham, who were viewed as to be people who were of African descent, that they were then cursed. They were the descendants of Ham, and they were cursed with enslavement. They were cursed with as being at the very bottom. So this was used as their religious justification for the subjugation of an entire group of people, and of course the parallel elevation of another group of people on the basis of that.
Isabel, this is not a brand new idea. The idea of caste goes way back. Other historians have written about it. You quote many of them. Talk about how this idea has evolved.
It was a term that was especially current for those who were observing India during the 19th century, where the United States and India were clearly dealing with the history of British colonization, which the United States obviously freed itself from in 1776, and the corresponding recognition that a caste system had emerged, however, through slavery. And so there were those who made that connection. There were those in India who made the connection with and were inspired by the end of slavery. After the Civil War, there were several philosophers, Indian philosophers, who looked to the United States and said, this is an inspiration for us, that our lowest caste people can perhaps be free. But then it surged again in the 1930s, and that is when there were anthropologists and sociologists who went to the Jim Crow South, and they did ethnographies there. They spent many, many months there and lived among the people, studied that hierarchy there, and emerged with the term caste as the most accurate way to describe what they had researched and experienced and observed with Jim Crow, how there was this fixed hierarchy in which everything that you could and could not do in that world was based upon what you looked like, that there was this fixed bottom caste of African Americans. Many of them were sharecroppers and tied to the land. And then there were the people above them who positioned themselves above them as the dominant caste of the entire infrastructure, you might say, from the sheriffs to the business owners, to the owners of the land, who then would only allow African American workers to work for the right to live on the land and not permit them to actually, would not pay them. And so they observed what happened, what was going on there, and had actually been going on for many decades. They recorded it and they wrote about it and they used the term caste. It was through them and reading their work that I came to use the word caste for the Warmth of the Suns. And then this book is a continuation of that, of going deeper to understand the phenomenon.
More of my conversation with Isabel Wilkerson when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Isabel Wilkerson. Her new book is titled Caste: The Origins of Our Discontents. She's also the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, and she was the first Black woman to win a Pulitzer Prize for Journalism in 1994 as the Chicago Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Isabel, tell me why you started this book in Germany.
I was working on this book to try to understand the origins of our discontents, which is the subtitle, and it has meaning. And I knew that I was going to have to get to India, and that was foremost in my mind. And then Charlottesville happened. And as a result of Charlottesville, that's what drew me into even looking at Germany to begin with, because, you know, with Charlottesville, there were the symbols coming together, symbols of Nazi Germany, symbols of the Confederacy, all merging in the symbolism that was being used by the ralliers themselves as they were protesting the removal, potential removal of the Robert E. Lee statue. So they are the ones that brought together these two cultures, these two phenomena of the Confederacy and the Nazis. They made the connection. And as a result of that, it got my attention, and I realized that there needed to be some connection or some recognition. I was interested in hearing how had Germany dealt with this history? How had Germany dealt with the memory? Here before our eyes in Charlottesville was a contention over memory, a contention over history, a contention of how we think about ourselves as a country and what's gone before us, a contention over the memory of the Civil War and of slavery. So I wanted to know, how was it that Germany had managed to deal with their history in the decades after World War II? How had they done this? How had they begun to both work toward it, to reconcile it, and then perhaps to atone for it? So that was the reason that I went to Berlin first, because I wanted to know what had they done. And then that led me to discoveries that I could never have imagined.
But there was a photograph you describe in that first chapter. Describe it for us.
That is a photograph of a sea of men, workers at a shipyard in Hamburg in the mid-1930s. And all of them are their arms outstretched, hailing to Hitler. And there's one man in the crowd, just one man in the crowd with his arms folded, and he's refusing to salute. He's refusing to recognize. He's refusing to participate in this. And he is the one man in the crowd who, in that moment, was on the right side of history. Everyone else there would have presumed themselves to be on the right side of history. They were doing what the society was calling upon them to do. And yet he stood alone. I think there's a message for all of us in our current era, or in any era, as to how far will you go? What will you do to stand up for what is right? Stand up for people who are being abused, people who are being held apart and subjugated. What will you do, and how will we stand up for them? I mean, I think it's a question for all of us, especially in this era now that we're in, where we're in such a time of division and upheaval. We all have a choice to make as to where we will stand and what we stand for.
So in the moment that we now live, many, many white people say to themselves, my family had nothing to do with slavery. I'm not a racist. What does any of this have to do with me? So is that denial of history? Is it denial of family? Is it denial of everything we have led ourselves to believe?
I would like to believe that it's not knowing. You know, we have not been as well served by our education system in terms of really knowing our true history. After The Warmth of the Suns came out, one of the comments that I would get time and time again from people of all backgrounds was, I had no idea. I had no idea. And that book came out 10 years ago. I mean, obviously the country's been in existence for a very long time, and yet there are many people who just simply didn't know. So if you don't know, you know, you cannot be expected to be able to act in the same way as if you did know. Well, that brings us back to the house, the old house. You know, it's as if we have all inherited this old house and we did not build the house. We had nothing to do with the joists and the beams that might be a bit askew or the foundation that might have cracks in it. But once you are the owner of the house, then it becomes a responsibility. Before, no, that you had nothing to do with it. But once you take in ownership, you might say, and it's your responsibility, then it falls on all of us to rise to the occasion, to do what is necessary, to repair, to fortify, to change whatever is necessary to make it sound and stable for going for future generations.
You talk about Charlottesville, and yet the killing of George Floyd surely had to bring that not only into people's minds, but into their vision. They could see what was happening.
I would like to believe that we are on the cusp of an awakening on the part of people who were perhaps not in a position to see as closely as those who have to live with this every day. I was very heartened by the response to this, not just in the United States, but globally. In England, there was, in Bristol, there was the people gathered together, protesters went, and they actually took down a statue of one of the men who was an enslaver, who actually was one of the ship captains, who was a major slave trader out of England. And they did this after the George Floyd situation occurred, after he was killed. And so this was a massive response to what everyone could see was an injustice. And I think one of the challenges that we've faced as a country is that we've not always been on the same page about what has even happened in the country. We've not heard the same histories. We have not lived with the consequences of caste in the same ways. Where your position on the caste system affects how you're received by the caste system. It affects, as I said, affects your standing, benefit of the doubt accorded you, respect, and other things that accord to you, that I refer to as in some ways making people central without recognizing how that centrality can affect how they view the world. So in any case, being able to see finally our country more clearly, I would hope would lead to an awakening, lead us to a cusp of an awareness of how very connected we are and how interdependent we are on one another.
You talk about caste as helping us to understand what happened in the 2016 election. Explain what you mean.
Well, I come to this from the perspective of a historian, not a political scientist.
I understand.
And the lens of caste allows us to see things differently, see the behaviors of groups of people perhaps differently based upon where they fall in the hierarchy. Now, of course, everyone has free will to do whatever it is that they wish to do. When you look at the macro response to various events, then you can see that there is a continuum that seems to be, or behavior that seems to be connected to caste. And so in that election season and to the current day, it's often been said, why would working class people, thinking of working class white Americans, vote against their interests, vote against things or support policies that are intended to help working people, such things as universal health care for all or health care that's more easily accessible, housing, opportunities for housing.
And education.
Education, supporting education for all, public education. So why would a group of people who would be in some ways the prime beneficiaries of these policies then vote in such a way or act in such a way or express disapproval for the very things that are intended to help working people such as themselves? And it could be seen through the caste lens that actually it might be said that they are not voting against their own interests. They are not going against what would be best for them from their perspective. It could be said that supporting things that maintain the positioning that they have inherited in the caste system in a hierarchy is in their best interest. In other words, for people who have the least other factors and characteristics to rely on, the least education, the least access to good jobs, the least access to all the things that many people who are who better situated might have, that they might rely on this all the more, because this is the one characteristic that historically has put people in a position of higher standing, greater respect, benefit of the doubt, access to resources as a group. So it could be argued that maintaining hierarchy as it is in the best interest of some people, and that they would choose to maintain that in the long run, even if there are short-term losses or short-term effects of it.
At the same time, you say that caste is not hatred or even personal. It's just routine it's the natural order of things that has come to be.
Which is why it's hard to both identify, recognize, and to even fight, because you can't see it. If you can't see it and don't recognize how it's working in our lives, then it's harder to address it. And that's why I describe myself as like a building inspector who is presenting a report on the building to show us all, this is what we've inherited and this is where we are. You had asked earlier about the use of the word caste versus other words. And I find it liberating as a word because it lands differently on our ear, you know, on the American ear. It sounds different. It's a new kind of word. It's a concept that we don't often apply to ourselves or even think about that much at all. And it allows us to have new ways of seeing one another that don't carry the same emotional freighted language of other words that get used so much. I do not suggest that we should not be using the other words. I'm just presenting this, inviting people to consider another way of looking at ourselves. And I think that the beauty of this word, though, is that it takes us away from the blame, the shame, the guilt, all of those toxic emotions that get us stuck. It frees us from the sense of anyone necessarily being responsible for building it, and then allows us to see how, or maybe contemplate how we might be able to work toward resolving it.
Especially when we think about the work, as you quote in the book, of J. Craig Venter, the genomics expert who did the initial genome sequencing. Talk about his work.
You know, they sequenced the human genome and it turned out that there's an infinitesimal, just the tiniest difference between all of us. It's the tiny, tiny fraction of all the thousands and thousands of genes that make up a human being. There's the tiniest, you know, fraction that is responsible for the visible manifestations that have become the primary form of categorizing and ranking people, you know, in modern time. And yet it's based upon something so infinitesimal. There, in other words, there's very little difference between, you know, human beings. And those differences are physical and superficial. Why would it be that the most superficial aspects of oneself, the very things that you cannot change, then become the defining feature of who a person is, what one's life chances are said to be, where one is expected to rise or to fall, benefit of the doubt accruing to them, the ability of someone to interject themselves into your life in a moment of you just moving about your day and then to call the police on you for something that's routine, like sitting at a Starbucks waiting for a friend to arrive. These are the things that have been used, these superficial characteristics, the very things that you cannot change about yourself are the very things that have for so, so long been the determining factor of one's life chances in this country.
You write about the untouchables. And first of all, how were the untouchables cast into that level of India's society?
For thousands and thousands of years, it's very ancient culture, so much older than ours. And as I'd indicated, the four Varnas that determine the division of humanity there, the four Varnas. And then outside of the four Varnas is the outcast group, which is the untouchables. They were called untouchables and now they are called Dalits. And these are people who were called untouchables because it was thought that said that the mere touch to someone who was upper caste, dominant caste, from a Dalit, untouchable, was polluting, and that there were rituals that had to be used in order to cleanse oneself if one had the misfortune of having been touched or even the shadow of an untouchable. Clear delineations about what people could and could not do. These were the people who had the lowliest, dirtiest jobs that they were assigned to, not just assigned to, but born to. They inherited the lowly positions, the lowliest, dirtiest jobs that their forefathers had served as. And they were fulfilling their destiny as being at the lowest of the low in the caste system. And they are still the people to this day who suffer the greatest discrimination in that country to this day. But, you know, in the same ways that African Americans have been assigned to the bottom rung, the arbitrary nature of this gets shown through the experiences of the people who are able to push through. I mean, in spite of everything, people in both of these groups have managed to push through and still rise to incredible heights. I mean, obviously we had an African-American president. There have been Dalits who have been, now known as Dalits who have moved into spaces of professions and in spite of the restrictions on them. And when you see these successes, it makes me feel all the depth of the tragedy, because so many people had been deprived of the ability to actually do what their talent would have called for them to do.
I love the story you tell about Martin Luther King and his visit to Mohandas Gandhi.
Yes, so that was in the winter of 1959, and he had been inspired by Gandhi for his nonviolent protest, as we also famously know. And so he finally had the opportunity to get to the land of Gandhi, and upon arrival, he was treated like a visiting celebrity because they had been following. India has, they followed him and the movement, and he ended up being greeted by the prime minister and was having a wonderful visit there. He chose to visit where Untouchables attended, an Untouchable school. And the principal introduced him to the students there. And he said, young people, I want to introduce you to a fellow Untouchable from America. And he heard that, Dr. King heard that. And he at first was a bit peeved by that. He was at first peeved. He thought to himself, here I've, come all the way from the United States. I've had dinner with the prime minister. I'm treated like a dignitary and celebrity, actually, everywhere he went. And here they're seeing me as an untouchable. And he did not view himself that way. And then he thought about it. And he thought about the people that he was fighting for. He thought about the sheriff's hoses, the fire hoses and the dogs and all of the protests that they had been having to do. And he realized that, yes, he was fighting for people who were at the very bottom. He realized, yes, I am an untouchable. And every Black person in the United States is an untouchable. And it renewed his desire to work toward what he already was working toward. But he had to think about that for a while and had to adjust to that, because it was not an instantaneous recognition that he would have had. And then he delivered a sermon. He talked about this revelation in a sermon that he delivered on July 4th, 1965 at Ebenezer Baptist Church. And there he told the story. That's how we know about the story, about his revelation and his recognition of the caste system in America. He made that recognition too.
So now take us back to Germany and your visit there and how you see the United States in this moment as somehow comparable to the caste system that Germany created.
You know, as I was saying, I came to even, the only reason I even looked at Germany was after Charlottesville, and I had no idea what I was going to discover, and what I discovered was just wrenching, actually. I had no idea that the German eugenicists turned to the American eugenicists and were in constant dialogue with American eugenicists in the years leading up to the Third Reich. I had no idea that American eugenicists wrote books that were big, big sellers in Germany in the years and decades leading up to the Third Reich. You know, the Nazis needed no one to teach them how to hate. They needed no one to tell them how to hate. But what they did was they sent researchers to the United States to study the Jim Crow laws, to see how the United States had subjugated its lowest caste people, you might say African Americans. They sent people to study what the United States had done to separate and segregate and control African Americans as they were creating the Nuremberg laws. They looked at the miscegenation laws, they looked at the segregation laws, they looked at all of these things as they were forming their own Nuremberg laws. That was just wrenching to discover. I would have had no idea. And to see that connection even now is just stunning, stunning to recognize.
Do you believe that they have gotten beyond that now?
I would never presume to say what is the predominant circumstance of another country. I would only say that I think that there are things that we can learn from how they have reconciled and adjusted themselves to creating a better understanding of what happened. How have they dealt with their history? And among the things that they have done is that they have converted many of the sites that were connected to the Nazis into spaces of education and understanding. They have converted them into museums. Of course, many of us know about the preservation, the necessary preservation of the concentration camps, which every human being needs to see what happened there. The horror and terror, unknown to man in any other way, just it's gut-wrenching beyond belief. They also, though, have converted other buildings and headquarters and other facilities that the Nazis used. They've preserved those and turned them into museums. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of museums with an effort to putting this into context, educating people so that this would never, ever happen again. They also have these beautiful tributes to those who perished in the Holocaust in the form of what are called stumbling stones. They are small, the size of cobblestone brass plates that are implanted outside the front doors of the last known residents of people who perished in the concentration camps, perished in the Holocaust. And I became so just focused on them because I just thought it was such an incredibly beautiful tribute of honor to people who perished. And the way that they're situated is you have to bend in order to read them because they're literally in the cobblestone. And that forces you to, in some ways, bow in honor of what they suffered. And I think that these are the many ways that they have come to recognize their history, seek to atone for that history, and then to make sure that succeeding generations know what happened. I think that that's a lesson for probably any country that has had a difficult, challenging history. There's no history that is comparable to what happened there, but there are still lessons for all of us to learn.
Isabel, you recount in this book some of the many ways our caste system has shaped your own life. Talk about that.
Well, I have had the same kind of restrictions that, let me put it this way, the intrusion of caste at any given moment can rear itself when you least expect it. And it has an impact on me and also has an impact on whatever it is I might be trying to do. I mean, one of the examples that I gave in the book is one where I was a national correspondent for the New York Times and I was writing what was a fairly routine story. I called up people ahead of time to let them know that just to make arrangements to interview them. Everyone I called was perfectly fine with it. In fact, looking forward to it because they wanted to talk with a reporter from the New York Times. Of course they did. And everything was fine. I went through my day interviewing people. Everything was fine until I got to the last interview. I arrived at the location, the establishment, retail establishment where the interview was to take place. It was a quiet hour of the day, so no one else was there. Very, very quiet, small establishment. And the person that I met first was one of the assistants there, but the person I was to interview, the store manager, was not there yet. So she just said, you know, he should be here any minute. He's running a little late, and he should be here any minute. And minutes later, the door opens, and this man walks in. He's in a rush. He's clearly a bit stressed because he's running late. He's taking off his coat, and I come up to him excited, thinking that, good, we'll be able to get the interview started. And I introduce myself and I say, I'm Isabel Wilkerson to interview you. And he said, well, how do I know that? And I said, well, we have an appointment. We made an appointment for this time for 4:30 and it's now after that time. And here I am to interview you. And he said, well, do you have a business card that I could see? And I said, actually, it was the end of the day and I was out of the business cards. I'd given them out earlier in the day. And I said, no, I happen to be out of them. And so then he said, well, do you have some ID? Can I see some ID? And I said, well, I shouldn't have to show you ID. We should be interviewing right now. I shouldn't have to show you ID, but here it is. I showed him the driver's license. And he said, you don't have anything that has a New York Times on it. Said, we should be in the interview right now. No one else has come in. We are 15, 20 minutes into what should be an interview. No one has come in. I am here. We should be doing the interview. And he said, I'm going to have to ask you to leave because the New York Times will be here any minute. I walked out the door, still, you know, flummoxed as to how this could have happened, what was going on. I obviously couldn't include him in the piece. I mean, he refused to be interviewed. He refused to be interviewed by me. And I wrote the piece and got it done. It ended up not being necessary for the piece to be done. It would have been nice, but I got it done. But the lesson of that is that at any given moment, these assumptions having to do with one's placement. A caste system is, if nothing else, a hierarchy in which where you are located, it's about boundaries and expectations of who can be where, who should be doing what, who is allowed to be doing this. It's about locating people in their proper place. In fact, in the original Jim Crow caste system, the idea of people staying in their place was part of the language. That was the way it was described, as people stepping out of their place would mean that they could get in deep trouble and even could lose their lives. So
they would have to step off the curb if a white person was walking ahead.
They literally had to stay in their place, whatever that meant in the moment. That meant stepping off a sidewalk, if it meant walking into the back door or side door. There were consequences, but it had to do with location and one's place, literal place. If you think about the word cast, and you think about the cast of a play, the characters in a play, and this person stands stage left, and this person stands stage right, and this person is in the front, and these people in the back, that is another use of the term cast that also shed light on how a caste system works and the animating characteristic of location and proper place. And in this example that I've just given, I was seen as out of place. I was not someone who would be seen as doing what I was saying I was doing, and he refused to believe otherwise, despite all evidence to the contrary, despite the fact that the person from the New York Times he was looking for had not shown up. I was there. I mean, what? I don't even know how the mind works. The mind works to create this. And in the end, why I speak about that and why I include it, and I must emphasize that I didn't wish to include anything related to myself. I'm really an old school journalist where you don't speak about yourself. But I thought that this would give a window into, in some ways, the absurdity of it and how everyone is hurt by this. So here's a person who, you know, was expecting, very excited and wanted to be interviewed by the New York Times and didn't get to because of the assumptions that were made. I was affected by it because it's hurtful, it's painful, it's a terrible feeling to have that happen. You're trying to figure out, what could this be? Why would he do this? And also, if you magnify or if you multiply this times millions of people who might experience something like this, you can begin to see how this affects us as a culture. You know, people just going about their day trying to get something done, and they're stopped or intercepted as they're trying to do what they're trying to do. And then that hurts the entire economy, the entire culture, because there are people who are not able to do what they're supposed to do because there's some disruption that they didn't expect. The delays that occur because someone's pulled over or because the police are called on you and you then have to deal with that. These are disruptions that affect not just the targets of this, but the entire society. Because it's a waste of time and energy that could be used in much more productive ways.
So, as you've said, we are at a very important moment in our history. Do you believe it's possible at this point to imagine an end to caste in America?
You know, I am so heartened by the spontaneous recognition by so many millions of people about what happened to George Floyd. I think that that shows that people do recognize injustices when they see them. People can transcend the barriers that have been erected around us when they are faced with a human being that they can connect with and they can see so clearly has been wronged. And that is what gives me hope. I would hope that people could see that we all have so much more in common than we've been led to believe, from the genomics, for example, studies, to the recognition or sense of empathy that a person might feel when they see these viral videos of people being disrupted in their everyday lives. I would hope it would be something that would allow us to see the tremendous loss to all of us, not just to the people who are targeted, but to all of us. One of the great losses that occurs in a caste system is the misspent and lost potential of so many people who never get to be what they actually truly are. I mentioned the lawyer who within inside is an artist. I mean, that I think of caste as operating on that level too. In a world without caste, we would all be able to be who we were truly intended to be, not what society says that we are, not what others expect us to be, but what we actually truly are. And if we were all doing what were truly our strengths, then we would be, more whole as individuals, and then that would make for a more holistic society as well. You know, the sense of threat and insecurity, which can foment divisions, would be, in my view, in my utopian view, would be lessened because people would be whole and full within themselves. I mean, that's what I hope for everyone. I mean, this is more than just caste in the terms of how it exists in India or, you know, race in the United States. But this is about seeing ourselves differently to truly transcend the divisions and the barriers that we didn't erect, but which we live with now. And if we were able to do that, then I could imagine a world in which we would be rooting not for a particular team that looks like us, but we would be rooting for the species and for the planet. That would be my goal, and that would be my dream.
Isabel, thank you so much. And congratulations on this book. It's magnificent.
Thank you so much. It's so beautiful to talk with you. Thank you.
That was Isabel Wilkerson. Her new book is titled Caste: The Origins of Our Discontents. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all, and please do wear those masks. Stay safe, stay well. I'm Diane Rehm.